Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio's August Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. Welcome back, Gary.
Happy to be here.
All right. That is good. Hey, listen, we've got all kinds of things. We have harvest. We're right in this, on this table here in the recording. We have garlic that was harvested just last night.
Yeah, it smells good, too.
Ah, yes. And we've got the tomato quiz, and we've got what's happening in your garden, your orchard, and we've got some myths. I'm looking forward to that, too. But, Sue, would you lead us with a word of prayer?
Certainly. Heavenly Father, thank you for this lovely weather that we've been having. And the harvest is starting to come in, so we can appreciate all the amazing things that you have created for us to enjoy. And now we're going to learn more about them, and hopefully that'll teach us more about you. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Looks like we're going to have a tomato quiz.
That's right.
All right.
Let's get started, Tom.
Okay.
Okay. The first one is a botany question.
Botany.
Botanically, a tomato is classified as... a vegetable?
A fruit.
Wait a minute. It's more detailed than that. A berry, a drupe, or a capsule. Those are all different types of fruits.
Let's call it a capsule.
Is it a vegetable?
Yeah,
a
I'm going to go with that.
A drupe or a capsule?
We'll go with capsule.
A capsule.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Would you like to call?
Yes.
Ask the audience?
Well, there's not much of an audience to ask here.
It was Kendra.
That's right.
And John.
Yes, we have John Duman, our recording engineer, and Kendra Maynor, who does our voice recording every other week, and she's going to be doing more hosting.
Well, botanically, it is a berry.
Berry.
Yeah. Oh, Tom, we fell down on the job.
Remember I said it's a botany classification. And a berry comes from a single flower, and it's fleshy all the way through. So you're talking about things like tomatoes, grapes, blueberries. Those are all true berries. A strawberry is not actually a true berry.
So what is it?
It is a...
It's a drupe, isn't it?
No. Droops, examples of droops would be something that has soft flesh, but it has a hard core.
Like a peach?
Yeah, like a peach. It has a pit in the middle, and inside that pit you have your seeds. So peaches, cherries, mangoes, olives, avocados, things, those are all drupes. And then the capsule is a dried fruit, and it carries multiple seeds. And examples of that would be poppies, lilies, orchids, cotton.
Okay.
Now, a strawberry is actually an enlarged receptacle, and the actual fruit of that is the little seed.
Okay.
So those are called,
seeds are on the outside, right?
Right, and those are called achenes.
That's all good to know.
And you'll forget about tomorrow.
That's right.
All right, number two.
If we don't write it down.
Yeah, that's true. Approximately how many cultivated tomato varieties are estimated to exist worldwide? Is it about 500? About 2,000? About 5,000? Or more than 10,000?
Boy, that's tough because there's like all the kinds that people have made at home, like Charlie So-and-so's mortgage lifter, radiator shop mortgage lifter, and weird names like that they do in their backyard. I don't know. 5,000 at least, maybe?
I think we can eliminate the two lowest ones, because once upon a time I was in a bookstore and they had one of those tabletop coffee table books, and it was the Vegetable Bible, and it's just amazing. Every variety of vegetable they have touch on the subject. Of course, they don't categorize all of them, so I'm going to be somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000, but I'm going to say 5,000.
And you would be wrong.
Oh, it's 10,000.
Oh,
it's
no.
It's more than 10,000.
Wow.
Number three,
more than potatoes.
It's a lot. What caused some wealthy Europeans to become ill after eating tomatoes in the 16th and 17th century, reinforcing the myth that tomatoes were poisonous? Was it naturally occurring tomato toxins? Acidic tomatoes leached lead from pewter plates? Poisonous insects feeding on tomatoes, or undercooked tomato seeds?
I'm going with the lead plates.
Tom, what do you think?
Well, that seems to be the only logical one to me.
That's exactly it.
Is that how they ended up with the name, like Wolf Peaches or Love Apples?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't heard it listed for that reason, but I know the reason why there was the Mad Hatter in, what was that?
Alice in Wonderland.
That was lead leaching into the guy's skin, which was causing mental issues.
Really?
Okay.
Oh, I thought it was the mercury they used in making felt top hats.
Maybe it was mercury instead of lead. You're probably right, be right on that one. Both of them are very toxic to people if it gets into your skin. We used to play with mercury at home.
My mom told us never to play with it. So when the kids in fifth and sixth grade did, I stayed far, far away.
Well, I didn't know
any
better.
Mom was
my uncle gave me some mercury,
stuff.
And we used to waste it all over the place. It was terrible.
I watched people how they would separate and then come back together. It's a magic metal.
Okay. Number four, which pigment is primarily responsible for the red color in ripe tomatoes? Anthocyanins? Chlorophyll, lycopene, or xanthophyll?
It's got to be lycopene. I know it's not chlorophyll because that's green.
That's right. It is lycopene. Remember that because you're going to hear it again.
Uh-oh.
Tomatoes are native to which region? Mediterranean Basin, Southeast Asia, Western South America, or Central Africa?
South America.
South America.
That would be correct.
Because we read the book, didn't we, Sue?
We read that book, Precious Cargo.
Now, we've talked about this once before. In 1893, the U.S. Supreme Court case Nix versus Hedden ruled tomatoes should be legally classified as A, fruit, B, vegetables, C, herbs, D, legumes.
Well,
vegetables.
I would say vegetable. That's been the myth that we've all grown up with. So I assume that is what happened.
That's true. And it was all about whether they were going to have to pay taxes.
Really?
If it was the fruit, they didn't have to pay whatever the duty was or whatever it was back in those days. Okay, blossom.
Figures, it's like a shotgun house.
Pardon? Say it again?
It's like a shotgun house. You pay less taxes the narrower your house were. That's why they had shotgun houses where it was one room after another.
No,
instead of having like...
I wonder if that would work in Michigan.
It's kind of like lakefront property. You don't pay by the square footage or in general, you're paying by the linear foot along the lake or river.
Hmm. Number seven, blossom end rot in tomatoes is most commonly associated with A, nitrogen toxicity, B, fungal infection, C, calcium deficiency caused by inconsistent watering, D, excessive phosphorus.
Calcium deficiency.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the calcium.
Yeah, we've talked about that before. Okay, number eight, which gas naturally accelerates tomato ripening? Is it carbon dioxide, oxygen, ethylene, or nitrogen?
Ethylene.
Ethylene.
That's right. And the reason they do that is because ripe tomatoes don't ship very well. And I took a tour of the Myers warehouse, and they had these big rooms where they put avocados and tomatoes in, and
really?
They pump ethylene gas in there to get them to ripen before they go.
Is this in Lansing or in Grand Rapids?
Yeah, it's in the Lansing area. Yeah, I'm sure they have one in Grand Rapids, too. Yeah, it was quite interesting, but we've talked about ethylene before. It's one of the natural gases that is considered, what do you want to say? It's a hormone, plant hormone.
It's a signal, isn't it? I mean, that's why you stick a apple into a bag of avocados or bananas
or
whatever.
It speeds up the ripening process. Okay, 9. Which cooking process actually increases the body's ability to absorb lycopene from tomatoes? Is it freezing, drying, cooking with a small amount of oil, or juicing without heating?
I'd say cooking.
Cooking.
Definitely
cooking. It increases the lycopene.
That's right. And I would use a little bit of olive oil.
Okay, is that for taste, or does that help?
Well, yeah, taste is part of it. Tomatoes and olive oil go together really well.
Isn't it also that some things you need, at least some vitamins need, they're not water-soluble, they need a tiny bit of fat to do their work?
Well, tiny bit of fat is needed to pick up certain vitamins. Like if you take vitamin D with some type of a fat, like oil or a piece of avocado, it will be better absorbed. Mm-hmm. So we have what we call water-soluble vitamins and fat-soluble vitamins. Okay, so number 10, what is the main reason commercial tomatoes are often harvested before they are ripe? They taste sweeter green, they transport better and are less likely to be damaged, they contain more vitamins, they cannot ripen on the vine.
Transport.
They transport better.
Yeah, I was going to get really upset if you guys missed that one.
Because you already told us.
Yeah.
That's being quiz smart, right?
Yep. Okay. Which disease is caused by the pathogen Phytophthora infestans? Is it Fusarium wilt, Septoria leaf spot, late blight, or bacterial speck? This was a little tougher.
It is tough.
I'll give you a hint after I read them again. Is it Fusarium wilt, Septoria leaf spot, late blight, or bacterial speck? And your hint is it's the same thing that affected the Irish in the 1800s.
That
it caused a lot of people to come here.
The potato blight.
Oh, yeah, that blight. Potatoes and tomatoes are both nightshades, right?
That's right. So.
So yeah, I'm gonna go with that.
That would be correct. Late blight. It's a nasty disease too. If you've ever had it in your garden, it by the time you notice it, if you were to pick all the green tomatoes, the disease is already in them, and everything just collapses. It's sad.
I think when we were in Grand Rapids, I had that for 2 or 3 years. It just
usually in wetter, cooler years is when you tend to get that disease. Okay, number 13. Which country currently produces the greatest quantity of tomatoes in the world? Is it the
China.
United States, India, China, or Italy?
China, of course.
What do you say, Tom?
Well.
Italians lose a lot of tomatoes, too.
Yeah, but I still don't think that they're the leader. So we'll go with the usual answer of China.
And you would be right. China.
I wouldn't be surprised if the Italians ate more per capita.
Yeah.
But the Chinese have so much more population, they probably statistically eat more, you know,
well,
in general, but I think per person, I think the Italians probably eat more per person.
And the interesting thing is they don't have nearly the amount of productive land that we have here in the United States.
Hmm.
That's one of the reasons why they have to import so much food.
You know, it's interesting. Down in Texas, on the Texas-Mexican border, there's a bridge at McAllen that's called the Tomato Bridge. And that's because they import the tomatoes from Mexico.
We import a lot from Mexico. As a matter of fact, this is kind of off, but I was looking at Special K today.
Really?
And this was the Special K with the strawberries in it.
Right.
And I was wondering if they listed where the strawberries came from, because a lot of dried strawberries come from China. And I looked and looked and looked, and I found out that Kellogg's, even though they're in Battle Creek, the whole cereal box came from Mexico.
Oh, the whole thing.
It wasn't even
imported.
Wasn't even made in Michigan.
Mm.
That was that was a bit of an issue. But anyway, number 14. Which antioxidant found in tomatoes has been extensively studied for potential health benefits? Lutein, resveratrol, lycopene, or quercetin?
Lycopene.
Sue?
Say the question one more time.
Which antioxidant found in tomatoes has been extensively studied for potential health benefits? Lutein, resveratrol, lycopene, or quercetin?
Quercetin?
Yeah. It's Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. I guess it's quercetin.
I hate to say lycopene again because I feel like this is a trick question, but probably lycopene, maybe.
It is lycopene. It was not a trick question, and it's the same. It's also found in red bell peppers, watermelon, and guava.
So I got a question. Where do those distractor questions come from? Options on the multiple choice.
What do you mean by where do they come from?
Well, I'm just wondering, are there some trickiness to them? Or
No.
Gary is a tricky guy.
No, I'm not trying to be tricky here. I didn't purposely put any tricky questions in here. They're pretty straightforward. Which combination
of... I got a question about the lycopene.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's supposedly cooking the tomatoes, as we've learned, increases the lycopene. I have heard that because lycopene is also in watermelon, you know, red watermelon, that they say it increases the lycopene if you don't store the unopened melon in the refrigerator. If you, keep it on the counter, it increases the lycopene. Is that true?
No, in terms of increasing lycopene in tomatoes, when people cook tomatoes, it concentrates the lycopene. It doesn't increase it. So I don't know how stable it is. I'd have to look that up. The only thing I would expect if you're doing different things would be lycopene would decrease if it breaks down. I don't know how stable it is. But you're not increasing it at all. Whatever is in the fruit when you harvest it, that's all you're going to get.
But you
can concentrate it, because when you're cooking tomatoes, you're cooking a lot of water out, and you can eat a lot more concentrated tomato paste than you would eat just tomatoes. And that's why you're getting more lycopene.
Good to know.
Okay, number 15. Which combination of compounds are primarily responsible for the characteristic flavor of a ripe tomato? Is it sugars and starch, sugars, acids, and volatile aromatic compounds, protein and fiber, or chlorophyll and cellulose?
Sugar and acids.
I like the aromatic.
Yeah, that's all together. The sugar, the acids, and volatile aromatic compounds. That would be correct. Which storage method is most likely to reduce a tomato's flavor? Leaving it on the counter, storing it in a plastic bag, refrigerating it before it's fully ripe, or keeping it out of direct sunlight?
Refrigerating.
Yeah, refrigerating it.
Right. That's the correct one. Refrigerating it before it's fully ripe. And we have another one that's similar in terms of number 15. It says, approximately how many volatile aromatic compounds have scientists identified in tomatoes that contribute to flavor? Is it about 10, about 40, more than 400, over 5,000?
Wow.
Well, chocolate has over 500. And Well, maybe we'll just go, I'll go with 400.
I think 400 is a safe guess.
And it's good that you followed your sister because it's 400. But all that's right. Still a lot.
I would have been happy with 10 or 40.
And, you know, with all these different compounds, depending on how good your taste buds are, you're picking all that stuff up, and that's what makes the unique flavor of different cultivars.
That's awesome. Well, you've been listening to the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, and this is the monthly program on the second week of the month, and this is the August edition. Sue Majeure, my dear sister, and yours truly, Tom Majeure. We will be back after this break.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. Hey, Gary, the harvest is starting to be reaped here. I've got, I harvested garlic last night. We have three garlics. These are not cloves. What are these called?
These are individual cloves here.
Oh,
I mean, it's the bulb, and then the cloves
are
in the bulb.
So we have a bulb that was just harvested last night. Also, I harvested my first onion of the year. I don't know if it's too early or not, but how do you tell when a garlic or an onion are ready to be harvested?
Well, with garlic, the top will start to die down.
And how much does it have to die? I've got some examples right here.
Well, this is still alive, and it probably would have grown some more if you would have left it in the ground.
Oh, don't tell me that.
Well, the bulb would have gotten bigger.
Okay.
But it's large enough to harvest right now.
Well, good.
And then, of course, it needs to dry out because it has different levels of this papery skin, and that's what causes it to be able to last for a while, is it develops that papery outer coating. And the same thing is true with onions.
Okay. So onions, there's not early or like a week or so you have to harvest it?
No, you can use an onion just as soon as it's big enough to use. But if you want the onion to get to this whatever size it's supposed to grow to, then you leave it in the ground. And when you're ready to harvest it, what they normally do is they just go over and break the green portion, and then the onion will start to dry. It's called curing.
Curing. So in some ways, basically, you can store your onions in the ground.
To a certain extent, you can. But if the ground gets too wet, then they'll rot. And also, when it freezes, they'll rot. They won't. You can't freeze an onion and expect it to be useful afterwards.
So how do we know if we've got too much moisture? Do you see puddles or?
Well, what people normally do is when the onions have reached the size that they want, and as I said, you just take something and roll down the tops, let it sit there for about a week and so that the outer skin will dry. Then you harvest the onion and then you hang them up, and they're kept in a somewhat warm. You don't want the temperature to drop down to freezing, and then they just hang them where it's dry. You could do it in your basement, although during the fall, the humidity might be a little high unless you have air conditioning, but they'll be okay.
So could we
put How long do they last when they're cured?
It depends on what shape they are when you take them out of the ground. If they have been fed on by insects or have cuts or breaks or anything like that, you can get a few months out of them. But if they've been damaged in any way, then you might start having rotting at those sites.
How fragile are these bulbs?
They're pretty resilient. When we harvest garlic, it can last for months, but it usually doesn't because we use it so fast.
Okay, well, the green beans, I see green beans. I should be out there harvesting right now.
Yeah, green beans have been coming on for a while, and if you want to keep harvesting, then you should keep picking. Once you stop picking, then the message is sent by the plant because it has reproduced and produced seeds. Then it starts to go through something called senescence, where it stops growing, it stops flowering, stops producing. So if you want to keep the green beans producing, you keep picking.
Okay. Sweet peppers, we talked about this off mic here, but I've got something that's you can come down and inspect it in mm-hmm. person. But I have quite a few of them. They get something black on the stem just above the ground, and they start wilting, and it's a bad scene.
Yeah, that's not enough information to know for sure. That type of thing, what you'd probably have to do is send a sample to the diagnostic lab. It's possible it could be a fungal disease. Bacterial diseases are a little less common on pepper plants and home gardens, so you'd have to send the sample in to determine what it is for sure.
And I'll do. We talked about that, and I was gone at the, when we talked, but I make that a priority tomorrow. Well, we can jump into the various things. What fruits? Got blueberries out there, so enjoying those.
Yeah, we're into the blueberry harvesting period. Peak season is August, and they will continue into September. And right now, in August, as we get into August, we'll get Blue Crop, Draper, Jersey, Chandler, Liberty, Elliot. And Elliot will go late August into September. But you're going to be in the main time for harvesting blueberries. And remember, birds love blueberries. They will clean you out. So if you don't have some kind of a net over them, then don't expect to get any.
We were down in Georgia. My son has wonderful blueberry plants that are as tall as I am. And they were, let's see, when were we down there? I think we were down there in after camp meeting. I think that was basically last week in June, and that was pretty much the end of the season down there.
They're way ahead of us. And they have different type of blueberries down there. They have what's called rabbit eye blueberries. And they're not the same as the northern blueberries, like the high bush blueberries, which is the ones that we grow up here the most. But most people think of apples as being a fall crop, but we do have some apples that are ready in August, which would include things like Paula Red, Ginger Gold, Zestar, Sansa, Gala. Those are all apples that come out. And when you get to late August in southern Michigan, then you'll start to get McIntosh also, and also Honeycrisp. If you happen to have that tree in your yard, that's late August in southern Michigan. And of course, if you go further down in, say, Indiana or Illinois, they're going to be a week or so sooner. Pardon?
I said Honeycrisp, my personal favorite.
I really like Honeycrisp too. There was another one that replaced it called Sweet Tango. And Sweet Tango is good, too. They're both very good apples, but you can buy a Honeycrisp tree and grow it in your yard, where a Sweet Tango is a club variety, which means that unless you're in the club, you can't get the tree.
Hmm. I haven't tried the Sweet Tango, but the reason I love this Honeycrisp so much is it has a nice thin skin. It isn't all tough on its skin like some of the Red Delicious have gotten, and it has the perfect balance of sweet and tart. I don't want an apple that's too sweet or too tart. I like to have the balance of sweet and tart.
I think we're very similar, Sue, especially when it comes to cooking. I like that balance, and that's why I like certain apples for pies.
Let me ask you this question. I was driving around this area, and I saw a number of apples laying on the ground. Is that a good thing? Apple drops
now,
are not good in an orchard.
McIntosh, for instance, is notorious for dropping apples early. And there are materials that commercial growers use to help to keep from getting that early drop, because once you're getting close to ripening, there's something called an abscission layer that develops between the stem and the stem of the apple and the actual stem of the plant.
The branch or whatever.
And that is also a hormonal response from something called abscisic acid. And once that starts to break down, then it doesn't take much of a wind to blow the apples down. And so,
how the deer must love that.
Well, yeah, but they can reach up and pick apples off the trees anyway. So
I've seen them on their back feet.
Oh yeah, they can reach up about 6-7 feet. So they can get some apples if they want them.
So what about, how do you tell when a peach is ready? I mean, they look a certain color, but sometimes it's still green inside.
Well, depending on the variety, for instance, Red Haven, you know, is going to be ready about the second week of August. And then a lot of other cultivars, when you look in the books, it'll say 5 days after Red Haven. They kind of use Red Haven as a standard. Mm-hmm. And then they'll put everything else on either side of the Red Havens. That's one thing, the calendar date. Another thing is the color. Usually they'll start to get a blush of reddish or orangish color. And with peaches, they give off a peachy smell when they're ready. Like pears aren't like that, or apples. They don't really have a smell when they're ripe. But peaches do. So that's one thing I do. I go out and sniff the peaches. But also you can squeeze them a little bit, and they start to give ever so little when they're ready to pick. And if you were to pick a peach about that time, you take it in the house, within a couple of days, it'll be really soft.
And the fruit flies will be there.
Yeah, well, the fruit flies don't necessarily wait till it's ripe either, because we have that new fruit fly that's the spotted wing Drosophila. And that one will actually attack fruit when it's ripening, not it won't wait until it's fully ripe.
You know, you were saying gently squeeze.
I'm sporting.
And I was thinking about the toilet paper commercial, don't squeeze the Charmin.
Well, you really have to learn how to do it, because you can squeeze and find out if it's going to give without bruising the fruit. But it takes a little practice to do that. But usually when people start to smell that peachy smell, then you're really close.
You talked about blush. Different peaches have different level of coloring.
Some peaches will turn more reddish with the coloring. Others will be lighter in color. And also, the color can be affected by where the fruit is on the tree. So if, say, for instance, you don't prune properly, then and the fruit is to the interior of the tree, it'll be lighter in color than it will be if it's in full sunlight. And that's true of the apples, too.
And I've noticed that if it's on the sunny side, you're going to get more red or so on and so forth.
Well, if your orchard is where it should be, it's going to be on the sunny side all day long. You don't want to have it in shade at all if you can help it. And then, of course, pears start in August, and some of the ones that are ready are Bartlett, Clapp's favorite, Harlow, the Bosque pears are ready during that time. And some of them are about late August going into September, so it depends what the actual ones are.
So let's just kind of drill down the list. What about plums?
Plums will be ready in August also. The Japanese plums like Shiro will be ready. The European plums like Damson or Stanley, they'll be getting ready also. And they will generally be about late August going into September. So they kind of go
through. What about bubblegum plums?
I don't know the exact time that particular plum is, but it's probably sometime in August.
What about?
I got some at Horrocks once. It was like a local, you know, and they only had them briefly. But those were like the best little plums because the skins weren't bitter. They were so tasty.
Did they actually taste like bubblegum?
I don't think that they did taste strictly like bubblegum. They were very sweet. They were not a dark plum. They were the yellow reddish flesh. They're not big. They're small. And they had like yellow skins with a red blush, but I loved them because they were ripe and sweet. They were local, and they didn't have that bitterness in the skins of plums. I like plums, but some of them, the interior is great, but the skin's kind of bitter.
Yeah, I don't mind. I like a slightly tart skin, and a lot of plums will be sweet through the flesh, and then as you get down toward the pit, they'll be a little more tart. And I actually like that. I don't like things that are just sweet.
What about, you talked about how to see if an apple is ripe, but what about pears and plums?
Pears, one of the things you can tell about pears, they start to drop when they're fully ripe. And the same thing, you look at the calendar date, they don't give as much as a peach will. It'll still be quite firm and still be ready to eat. But you don't want a pear to ripen on the tree, because if it ripens on the tree, it develops what they call stone cells, and it's a little gritty. Yeah, it really lowers the quality of the fruit. It doesn't hurt them, but it's okay to eat, but people don't like that grittiness. So when you're getting close to the time that the pear should be harvested, say within a week or two, then you can harvest those and then let them ripen at room temperature. Mm-hmm. And there are pears that'll be ready in the next week or so.
I'm glad you reminded me of this. About
when are suckle pears ripe?
The suckle pear is going to be about mid-August. I think I have it on
okay.
here. Let me just look here. Hold on a second.
They're my favorite. They used to have them sometimes at Meijer's. I've been seen them for a few years, and I'm sorry, because to me they're the best. They're tiny.
Yeah, they're not that big, but they're
when
sweet.
When they're perfectly ripe, and you're like biting into it, they have a real faint rose scent. Mm-hmm. I really like them.
Yeah, they're late August is when they're ready.
What about storage, and how long do these fruits last?
Well, the big thing about storage is temperature.
Okay.
And also keeping them away from anything that gives off ethylene. So normally the ethylene issue isn't going to be too much of a problem unless you're harvesting a lot of something and you're keeping it in a small space, because the fruit themselves, as it ripens, give off ethylene, and that will speed up the process. But for the most part, you want to cool things down. And
what temperature?
Well, most people can't do that. You're talking about in the mid-30s. Basically, you'd have to have like a walk-in freezer type of thing, or walk-in refrigerator.
What temperature is your refrigerator? Usually 45?
No. It's around the mid-30s. It's okay. The refrigerator is a good place to store, but if you have a whole peach tree, for instance, you need to process them. You either need to freeze them or can them, because you're not going to be able to store them very long in the refrigerator.
Now, pears have a longer shelf life than peaches.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, you can keep a pear in the refrigerator for weeks. Peaches, after about a week, they're going to get soft.
And prunes? I mean, the plums?
Plums are more like the peaches. They do last a little bit longer than peaches do, but you'll get a couple of weeks out of them.
Let's talk a little bit about pruning as we go into the break.
Okay, well, one of the reasons why people would prune this time of year, especially on fruit trees, is to slow down their growth. Like if you go out in your orchard right now, you'll see suckers coming up from the base, water sprouts are growing straight up. You can go out there and prune those out so you won't have to do it next year. And if the trees are too vigorous, like they're just putting on too much growth, by doing some thinning cuts and taking out some of the branches, you'll decrease the amount of wood which carries leaves, which makes sugars for next year's growth. By reducing that, you can slow down the growth of a tree.
That's awesome.
And then, of course, any time you have diseases like fire blight, if you happen to see it in your orchard, or some of the other diseases that'll kill some of the branches, you can prune those out at any time.
Very good. Well, you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, the August edition, with Gary Heilig, Sue Mazur, and Tom Mazur. We'll be back after this break.
Green trees and green grass gives us freely and cheerfully life-sustaining oxygen. Your green backs, when put to work for the Lord at Strong Tower Radio, can result in life-sustaining salvation to the lost, the effects of which can literally last forever. If you'd like to help change someone's life and be a cheerful giver to the cause of God, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the Donate button, or call 231-468-2087. Thanks for listening to, praying for, and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is changing lives, one listener at a time.
We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, the August edition with Gary Heilig, Tom Mazure, and Sue Mazure. Hey, we're going to be Mythbusters in this section.
Okay. Let's talk about them.
Okay, we're going to talk about garden myths. So, always remove tomato suckers. That's true?
No, it's not really.
Why?
When you think about a sucker, what a sucker is a branch that starts in the axil of a leaf. So you have a leaf on the branch, the branch is going up, you have a sucker growing in the side.
Comes in the middle.
That's right. That sucker is a stem, and that stem will eventually produce flowers, and it will eventually produce fruit. So you do reduce the capacity of that plant to produce a larger crop by taking off the suckers. Also, you will tend to have more problems with blossom end rot when you take off suckers. But
really?
But where that came from is commercial growers that are growing tomatoes in greenhouses generally did not want all those branches. So what they did is they would trim off the sucker so everything was growing up, which worked out well in terms of disease management because the thicker the plant is, the longer it takes for the leaves to dry off. And the easier it is for a fungal disease to get started. So I don't take off suckers at all.
Really?
I just let them go ahead and flower and produce fruit.
So they always have fruit for on that sucker?
They will produce fruit, yeah. It's just another stem. It just happens to grow out of the axil of the leaf. Mm-hmm. Now, some people swear by it. They want to do that. Hey, there's no problem if you want to do that. And if you're getting enough tomatoes doing some pruning, knock yourself out. But it's not the best thing to do.
Go ahead.
I was going to say also with indeterminate varieties, the ones that will keep growing until they get frosted, those plants can get pretty big and rangy.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why some people like to do some pruning and keep them in a smaller area.
Yes, I had some that went up to about 10, 12 feet.
Yeah, I've had some grow about 8 feet.
What about adding gravel to the bottom of containers for better drainage? That sounds like common sense.
Well, the best thing you could do is make sure you have a pot that has a hole in it. When you have a pot that doesn't have a hole in it and you put gravel in it, you basically set up a water table. In other words, once water level gets above the gravel, there's no drainage. You only have limited drainage to fill in the little air spaces between the gravel, and that's not very much water. So you may think that you're getting good drainage by doing that, but the best way to drain is to have a hole in that pot so that water can completely drain out.
And then
I've heard, Gary, that if you take pieces of like a terracotta pot, you know, a broken one,
mm-hmm.
and put them over the holes in the bottom, because, you know, the terracotta pots are usually curved. So what happens is the water drains out fine, but it doesn't wash the dirt away. Is that true?
Yeah, for the most part. But if you have a pot that is in a container that holds the water, like in the inside, you're not going to get very much soil coming out anyway, unless you have a lot of water moving through there. So, for instance, if you had a pot outside and it was in a place where it could get a lot of rain, then, yeah, you might have that situation where some soil will wash out. But most of the time, it's not a significant amount, but you'll lose some.
Ah.
Well, here's I assume it's a myth that I remember from my childhood that watering in the sun burns the leaves or the grass.
Well, the idea behind that was that the water droplets would act like a magnifying glass, and it would burn the leaves. Now, there are situations where you can get some damage on the leaves of certain plants. For instance, if you get water on an African violet leaf, it's going to leave a spot. But the idea that the sun will be increased by going through water droplets is not true at all.
So basically the focal length is not long enough to concentrate the sunlight to burn it.
It's just not going to burn. As a matter of fact, what strawberry growers, commercial strawberry growers would do when we had very hot sunny days, they would irrigate their plants. And what it would do is cool them off and slow down the ripening of the berries. So if that idea worked, that the sun could burn the leaves, it'd be burning up the strawberries pretty quickly, and that doesn't happen.
Oh, it's good to take care of that myth. More fertilizer means more flowers and bigger vegetables. Bigger is more is better.
Not necessarily.
That sounds fishy to me.
Yeah, well, the amount of fertilizer a plant is that needs to produce a crop is predetermined. In other words, they have determined how much, say, nitrogen a plant needs, or phosphorus, potassium. And if you put on the right amount, then the plant will have all its needs because it makes its own food. If you put too much fertilizer down, then you increase what's called the soluble salt level in the soil. And what happens when you put salt down on a sidewalk during the winter? What does it do to the grass next to the sidewalk?
It kills it.
But do you know why? It may not necessarily kill it all, but it causes it to turn brown.
I'm not quite sure. It probably disrupts the chlorophyll process. And so
well, during the winter, chlorophyll is not being made anyway.
Okay.
But what's happening is the salt will draw water out of the plant. It causes desiccation. And so when you put fertilizer on, too much fertilizer, it will draw water out of the plant and cause problems. And of course, if it's not getting what it needs, then the plant's not going to do very well. And to give you an example of this, I went over to a guy's house. I'd been talking to him on the phone, and he was saying his shrubs just were doing terrible. And I went through all the questions I could ask, and one of them was how much fertilizer he put down. And he said, not too much. So finally, I was frustrated, and I said, I'm going to make a home visit this guy. The ground was just flooded with fertilizer, and he had basically burned his plants up because it just drew all the water right out of the plants. So the idea of putting more is better, that's not necessarily the case.
Definitely diminishing returns, if not worse.
That's right. And if the
I heard in medieval times, if you were fighting with an enemy, and land was the base of all the power, of course, if you didn't want to just steal his castle and take over his serfs, if you really, really wanted to hurt the guy, after you defeated him, you sowed salt in his field so nobody could grow anything or eat.
Yeah, most plants are not salt tolerant. Asparagus is, but even asparagus has its limits. Yeah, you could really mess up the land by spreading salt all over the place.
Well, back then, salt was expensive, so they must have really been quite angry to spend money on salt.
Or quite rich.
What about this myth? All pruning must wait until winter.
Well, we've already talked about that. There's some times that pruning is helpful, and depending on what kind of plant it is will determine the best time. For instance, if something is a spring-blooming plant, then that means that those flower buds were produced the previous summer, late summer going into fall. And summer pruning is okay during that time because you prune right after it blooms, which for instance, lilacs would be around June. Where if you have something that blooms later in the summer, then that means it's going to flower on that current season's wood. You wouldn't want to do summer pruning then because you'd be pruning off the wood that would produce the flowers. So it really depends what plant it is, but there's some plants that can be pruned during the summer.
All right. Native plants never need watering.
Well, I can think of a time that native plants would need watering is when they're first getting established. is, say, for instance, you're planting some native grasses or wildflowers, those types of things. If they're not getting the rainfall that they need, if you don't give them the water, they're never going to get established, or they might just die. So that's not necessarily true. Now, once a native plant gets established, it doesn't need as much water as maybe some perennials that are being grown in an area that it doesn't normally grow in. Because a lot of the perennials we grow, they didn't originate in this part of the country. But if it's something that needs more moisture, you're going to have to give it extra water.
Even if it's a native plant.
Yeah, but like I said, once a native plant is established, they generally can do well in most years without supplemental water.
Organic pesticides are completely safe.
Oh, I think that's false.
To who?
Look at that. Well, I was just thinking about how disappointing it was to learn, like, if you're like, okay, I'm going to buy some of this organic oatmeal. And technically, they can say it's organic. They didn't spray any glyphosate on it, you know, Roundup while they were growing it. Then I found out that they can still call it organic if they sprayed the glyphosate or Roundup on it while they're harvesting. And I'm like, well, doesn't that defeat the whole purpose? You know?
Yeah, that doesn't sound right to me. But
it made me kind of frustrated.
The thing that I ran into a lot when I was working for Michigan State Extension was people thought that organic meant that no chemicals were used. And I would gently tell them, well, that's not quite true. It's just that it's a different group of chemicals. It might be something that is a biocide, in other words, or something that was derived from a plant. It might be a living organism, like a bacteria, for instance, but it's still considered a pesticide because pesticide simply means kill pest. Now, there are some advantages of many organic materials. For instance, they tend to be more direct, like Dipel, for instance, only affects the larva of the class of insects called Lepidoptera, which are butterflies and moths. And so it will kill something like tomato hornworm when it's small, or imported cabbage worm. But if a beetle came walking along, it wouldn't affect them at all. So that's one of the advantages of having those. But you also have to be careful with organic pesticides and read all the directions, because, for instance, spinosad, which is a very good organic pesticide, when it's sprayed on plants, you should allow it to dry before anything is exposed to it. And, for instance, honeybees and those types of things, beneficial insects. And the way that we do that is spraying really early in the morning before those predators are active, or really late at night after they're no longer active. Otherwise, some of these things can be toxic to beneficial things. So in terms of the myth that they're completely safe, no. I mean, you could drink Dipel and it won't have any effect on you at all. But if you were a butterfly on one of your crops that you didn't want, well, yeah, it could cause problems for the young when they hatch out, but it won't harm you at all.
You know, some people may think that organic means no chemicals, but everything is chemicals.
No, they're just different chemicals.
Just different chemicals.
Yeah.
Says that organic produce is not sprayed. Another myth, correct?
Yeah, it is sprayed. Otherwise, you'd have some ugly fruit and vegetables. Because you're spraying not only for insects, but you're also spraying for diseases. And diseases can be just as much of a problem as the insects.
Here's another one that if it's organic, it can't harm beneficial insecticides. And you talked about the pollinators.
Yeah, you just have to be sure that you read the label directions and use it properly. If you use just about any product properly, then the environmental effects will be much lower. But when people just do things willy-nilly, they're doing damage and they don't even realize it.
compost is a fertilizer.
Well, that's not true. We had a class called Master Composter once, and what we used to do is we composted about anything you could compost, and we did a nutrient analysis of every one of those compost experiments. And there are nutrients in compost, but not high enough levels to where you would call them a fertilizer. It would be considered a soil amendment that has some nutrients in it. So, for instance, you probably could grow a crop of lettuce pretty well in some compost because it's a very light feeder and doesn't need a lot of fertilizer. But I wouldn't want to try to grow corn or tomatoes and just compost without adding extra nutrients to get the best quality crop you could get. So it's not considered a fertilizer. It's a soil amendment.
That's good. Another related one is compost supplies all the nutrients plants need, and I think that's pretty close to the same.
It doesn't, no.
It provides some, but not all. Here's another one. You should add sand to clay soil.
No. Where I grew up in Saginaw, we had very heavy clay, and if you add sand to that, it forms like a brick, like cement. It becomes very difficult. Whenever you have less than an ideal soil, whether it's all sand, which is basically hydroponics because you don't really have any soil, what you want to do to improve it is add organic matter. So compost, animal manures, what we call green manures, which would be things like buckwheat or rye or other things that can be used. And you turn that organic matter into the soil. And over the years, you can make any soil a really good one.
So did I understand that not only do you add organic matter to sand, but you need to add it to clay also?
That's right. It improves any soil. See, clay is a very small, it's the smallest particle. There are three basic mineral particles in a soil: sand, silt, and clay. Sand is
quartz,
the more coarse one, the largest one, and then clay is the smallest one. Silt is in between. When you add organic matter, there are lots of things that happen. The bacteria, as it's breaking down the organic matter, produces certain what they call gums, and one is called geosmin, which I always thought that'd be a good name for a guy's aftershave, but anyway. What it does is cause the different particles in the soil, the organic matter, the sand, the silt, and the clay, to be associated together in what's called aggregates or PEDs. And you wouldn't see this unless you were looking at it under the microscope. So when you add organic matter, you will improve any kind of soil.
That's a good across-the-board solution. While the hour has gone quickly, the Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure with the Strong Tower Radio Network. Stay tuned. We'll be back next month for the September Good Growing with the Garden Guy. For Strong Tower Radio Network, I'm Tom Majeure. Bye now.